Chapter 27. A glum dusk was settling over London when Obinze walked into the bookshop cafe and sat down to a mocha and blueberry scone. The soles of his feet ached pleasantly. It was not very cold. He had been sweating in Nicholas's wool coat, which now hung on the back of his chair. This was his weekly treat, to visit the bookshop, buy an overpriced caffeinated drink, read as much as he could for free, and become Obinze again. Sometimes he asked to be dropped off in central London after a delivery, and he would wander about and end up in a bookshop and sink to the floor at a corner, away from the clusters of people. He read contemporary American fiction, because he hoped to find a resonance, a shaping of his longings, a sense of the America that he had imagined himself a part of. He wanted to know about day-to-day life in America, what people ate and what consumed them, what shamed them, and what attracted them. But he read novel after novel, and was disappointed. Nothing was grave, nothing serious, nothing urgent, and most dissolved into ironic nothingness. He read American newspapers and magazines, but only skimmed the British newspapers, because there were more and more articles about immigration, and each one stoked new panic in his chest. Schools swamped by asylum seekers. He still hadn't found someone. Last week, he had met two Nigerian men, distant friends of a friend, who said they knew an Eastern European woman, and he had paid them £100. Now they did not return his calls, and their mobile phones went directly to voicemail. His scone was half-eaten. He did not realize how quickly the cafe had filled up. He was comfortable, cozy even, and absorbed in a magazine article, when a woman and a little boy came up to ask if they could share his table. They were nut-colored and dark-haired. He imagined that they were Bangladeshi or Sri Lankan. "Of course," he said, and shifted his pile of books and magazines, even though it had not been on the side of the table that they would use. The boy looked 8 or 9 years old, wearing a Mickey Mouse sweater and clutching a blue Game Boy. The woman was wearing a nose ring, a tiny glass-like thing that glittered as she moved her head this way and that. She asked if he had enough room for his magazines, if he wanted her to move her chair a little. Then she told her son, in a laughing tone that was clearly intended for Obinze, that she had never been very sure if those narrow wooden sticks next to the packets of sugar were for stirring. "I'm not a baby," her son said when she wanted to cut his muffin. "I just thought it would be easier for you." Obinze looked up and saw that she was talking to her son, but she was watching him, with something wistful in her eyes. It filled him with possibility, this chance meeting with a stranger, and the thought of the paths on which it might lead him. The little boy had a delightful, curious face. "Do you live in London?" he asked Obinze. "Yes," Obinze said, but that yes did not tell his story, that he lived in London indeed, but invisibly, his existence like an erased pencil sketch. Each time he saw a policeman, or anyone in a uniform, anyone with the faintest scent of authority, he would fight the urge to run. "His father passed away last year," the woman said in a lower voice. "This is our first vacation in London without him. We used to do it every year before Christmas." The woman nodded continuously as she spoke, and the boy looked annoyed, as if he had not wanted Obinze to know that. "I'm sorry," Obinze said.
"We went to the Tate," the boy said.
"Did you like it?" Obinze asked. He scowled.
"It was boring."
His mother stood up. "We should go. We're going to see a play." She turned to her son and added, "You are not taking that Game Boy in. You know that."
The boy ignored her, said, "Bye,"
to Obinze, and turned towards the door. The mother gave Obinze a long look, even more wistful than before. Perhaps she had deeply loved her husband, and this, her first awareness of feeling attraction again, was a startling revelation. He watched them leave, wondering whether to get up and ask for her contact information, and yet knowing he would not. There was something about the woman that made him think of love, and as always, Ifemelu came to his mind when he thought of love. Then quite suddenly, a sexual urge overcame him, a tide of lust. He wanted to fuck somebody. He would text Tendai. They had met at a party Nosa took him to, and he ended up that night in her bed. Wise and large-hipped, and Zimbabwean Tendai, who had a habit of soaking in baths for too long. She stared at him in shock the first time he cleaned her flat and cooked jollof rice for her. She was so unused to being treated well by a man that she watched him endlessly, anxiously, her eyes veiled, as though holding her breath and waiting for the abuse to emerge. She knew he didn't have his papers.
Or you would be the kind of Nigerian working in IT in driving a BMW, she said.
She had a British stay and would have a passport in a year, and she hinted that she might be willing to help him. But he did not want the complication of marrying her for his papers. One day she would wake up and convince herself that it had never been merely for papers. Before he left the bookshop, he sent Tendai a text. Are you home? Was thinking of stopping by. A freezing drizzle was falling as he walked to the tube station, tiny raindrops splattering his coat, and when he got there, he was absorbed by how many blobs of saliva were on the stairs. Why did people not wait until they left the station to spit? He sat on the stained seat of the noisy train, opposite a woman reading the evening paper. Speak English at home, Blunkett tells immigrants. He imagined the article she was reading. There were so many of them now published in the newspapers, and they echoed the radio and television, even the chatter of some of the men in the warehouse. The wind blowing across the British Isles was odorous with fear of asylum seekers, infecting everybody with a panic of impending doom, and so articles were written and read, simply and stridently, as though the writers lived in a world in which the present was unconnected to the past, and they had never considered this to be the normal course of history, the influx into Britain of black and brown people from countries created by Britain. Yet he understood. It had to be comforting, this denial of history. The woman closed the newspaper and looked at him. She had stringy brown hair and hard, suspicious eyes. He wondered what she was thinking. Was she wondering whether he was one of those illegal immigrants who were overcrowding an already crowded island? Later on the train to Essex, he noticed that all the people around him were Nigerians. Loud conversations in Yoruba and Pidgin filled the carriage, and for a moment he saw the unfettered non-white foreignness of this scene through the suspicious eyes of the white woman on the tube. He thought again of the Sri Lankan or Bangladeshi woman, and the shadow of grief from which he was only just emerging, and he thought of his mother, and of Ifemelu, and the life he had imagined for himself, and the life he now had, lacquered as it was by work and reading, by panic and hope. He had never felt so lonely. Chapter 28. One morning in early summer, a renewing warmth in the air, Obinze arrived at the warehouse, and knew right away that something was amiss. The men avoided his eyes, an unnatural stiffness in their movements. And Nigel turned swiftly, too swiftly, towards the toilet when he saw Obinze. They knew. It had to be that they had somehow found out. They saw the headlines about asylum seekers draining the National Health Service. They knew of the hordes further crowding a crowded island. And now they knew that he was one of the damned, working with a name that was not his. Where was Roy Snell? Had he gone to call the police? Was it the police that one called? Obinze tried to remember details from the stories of people who had been caught and deported, but his mind was numb. He felt naked. He wanted to turn and run, but his body kept moving, against his will, towards the loading area. Then he sensed a movement behind him, quick and violent and too close, and before he could turn around, a paper hat had been pushed onto his head. It was Nigel, and with him a gathering of grinning men.
"Happy birthday, Vinny boy!"
they all said. Obinze froze, frightened by the complete blankness of his mind. Then he realized what it was. Vincent's birthday. Roy must have told the men. Even he had not remembered to remember Vincent's date of birth.
"Oh,"
was all he said, nauseous from relief. Nigel asked him to come into the coffee room, where all the men were trooping in, and as Obinze sat with them, all of them white, except for Patrick from Jamaica, passing around the muffins and coke they had bought with their own money in honor of a birthday they believed was his, a realization brought tears to his eyes. He felt safe. Vincent called him that evening, and Obinze was mildly surprised, because Vincent had called him only once, months ago, when he changed his bank and wanted to give him the new account number. He wondered whether to say happy birthday to Vincent, whether indeed the call was somehow related to the occasion of the birthday. "Vincent, Kedou," he said.
"I want a raise."
Had Vincent learned that from a film? Those words, "I want a raise," sounded contrived and comical.
"I want 45%. I know you are working more now."
"Vincent, uh-uh. How much am I making? You know I am saving money to do this marriage thing."
45%,
Vincent said, and hung up. Obinze decided to ignore him. He knew Vincent's type. They would push to see how far they could go, and then they would step back. If he called back and tried to negotiate, it might embolden Vincent to make more demands. That he walked in every week to Vincent's bank to deposit money into his account was something Vincent would not risk losing entirely. And so, when a week later, in the morning bustle of drivers and trucks, Roy said,
"Vinny boy, step into my office for a minute."
Obinze thought nothing of it. On Roy's desk was a newspaper, folded at the page with a photo of the big-breasted woman. Roy slowly put his cup of coffee on top of the newspaper. He seemed uncomfortable, not looking directly at Obinze.
"Somebody called yesterday. Said you're not who you say you are, that you're illegal and working with a Brit's name."
There was a pause. Obinze was stung with surprise. Roy picked up the coffee cup again.
"Why didn't you just bring in your passport tomorrow and we'll clear it up, all right?"
Obinze mumbled the first words that came to him.
"Okay, I'll bring my passport tomorrow."
He walked out of the office, knowing that he would never remember what he had felt moments ago. Was Roy merely asking him to bring his passport to make the dismissal easier for him, to give him an exit, or did Roy really believe that the caller had been wrong? Why would anybody call about such a thing, unless it was true? Obinze had never made as much of an effort as he did the rest of the day to seem normal, to tame the rage that was engulfing him. It was not the thought of the power that Vincent had over him that infuriated him, but the recklessness with which Vincent had exercised it. He left the warehouse that evening, for the final time, wishing more than anything that he had told Nigel and Roy his real name. Some years later, in Lagos, after Chief told him to find a white man whom he could present as his general manager, Obinze called Nigel. His mobile number had not changed.
"This is Vinny Boy."
"Vincent, are you all right, mate?"
"I'm fine. How are you?"
Obinze said.
Then later he said, "Vincent is not my real name, Nigel. My name is Obinze. I have a job offer for you in Nigeria."
Chapter 29. The Angolans told him how things had gone up, or were more tough. Opaque words that were supposed to explain each new request for more money.
"This is not what we agreed to," Obinze would say, or, "I don't have any extra cash right now."
And they would reply,
"Things have gone up, yeah,"
in a tone that he imagined was accompanied by a shrug. A silence would follow, a wordlessness over the phone line that told him that it was his problem, not theirs.
"I'll be it in by Friday," he would say finally, before hanging up.
Cleotilde's gentle sympathy assuaged him. She told him,
"They've got my passport."
And he thought this vaguely sinister, almost a hostage-holding.
"Otherwise we could just do this on our own," she added.
But he did not want to do it on his own, with Cleotilde. It was too important, and he needed the weight of the Angolans' expertise, their experience, to make sure all went well. Nicholas had already lent him some money. He had been loath enough to ask at all because of the judgment in Nicholas's unsmiling eyes, as though he was thinking that Obinze was soft, spoilt, and many people did not have a cousin who could lend them money. Emenike was the only other person he could ask. The last time they spoke, Emenike had told him,
"I don't know if you've seen this play in the West End, but Georgina and I have just been, and we loved it."
As though Obinze in his delivery job, saving austerely, consumed by immigration worries, would ever even think of seeing a West End play. Emenike's obliviousness had upset him, because it suggested a disregard, and even worse, an indifference to him and to his present life. He called Emenike and said, speaking quickly, pushing the words out, that he needed £500, which he would pay back as soon as he could find another job, and then, more slowly, he told Emenike about the Angolans and how close he was to finally doing the marriage ceremony, but there were so many extra costs that he had not budgeted for.
"No problem. Let's meet Friday," Emenike said.
Now Emenike sat across from Obinze in a dimly lit restaurant, after shrugging off his jacket to reveal a tan cashmere sweater that looked faultless. He had not put on weight like most of his other friends now living abroad. Didn't look different from the last time Obinze had seen him in Nsoka.
"Man, the Zed, you look well," he said,
his words aflame with dishonesty. Of course Obinze did not look well, shoulders hunched from stress, in clothes borrowed from his cousin.
"I beg sorry I haven't had time to see you. My work schedule is crazy, and we've also been traveling a lot. I would have asked you to come and stay with us, but it's not a decision I can take alone. Georgina won't understand. You know these Oyimbo people don't behave like us."
His lips moved, forming something that looked like a smirk. He was making fun of his wife, but Obinze knew from the muted awe in his tone that it was mockery colored by respect, mockery of what he believed, despite himself, to be inherently superior. Obinze remembered how Kayode had often said about Emenike in secondary school, "He can read all the books he wants, but the bush is still in his blood."
"We've just come back from America. Man, you need to go to America. No other country like it in the world. We flew to Denver and then drove to Wyoming. Georgina had just finished a really tough case. You remember I told you when I was going to Hong Kong? She was there for work and I flew over for a long weekend. So I thought we should go to America. She needed the holiday."
Emenike's phone beeped. He took it out of his pocket, glanced at it, and grimaced, as though he wanted to be asked what the text was about, but Obinze did not ask. He was tired. Iloba had given him his own national insurance card, even though it was risky for both of them to work at the same time, but all the job agencies Obinze had tried so far wanted to see a passport and not just the card. His beer tasted flat, and he wished Emenike would just give him the money. But Emenike resumed talking, gesturing, his movements fluid and sure, his manner still that of a person convinced they knew things that other people would never know. And yet there was something different in him that Obinze could not name. Emenike talked for a long time, often prefacing a story with,
"The thing you have to understand about this country is this."
Obinze's mind strayed to Cleotilde. The Angolan said at least two people from her side had to come to Newcastle to avoid any suspicion, but she had called him yesterday to suggest that she bring only one friend, so he would not have to pay for the train and hotel bills of two extra people. He had found it sweet, but he asked her to bring the two anyway. He would take no chances. Emenike was talking about something that had happened at work.
"I had actually arrived at the meeting first, kept my files, and then I went to the loo, only to come back and for this stupid Oyimbo man to tell me, 'Oh, I see you are keeping to African time.' And you know what? I just told him off. Since then he has been sending me emails to go for a drink." "Drink for what?"
Emenike sipped his beer. It was his third, and he had become looser and louder. All his stories about work had the same arc. Somebody would first underestimate or belittle him, and he would then end up victorious with a final clever word or action.
"I miss Niger. It's been so long, but I just haven't had the time to travel back home. Besides, Georgina would not survive a visit to Nigeria,"
Emenike said, and laughed. He had cast home as the jungle, and himself as interpreter of the jungle.
"Another beer?"
Emenike asked. Obinze shook his head. A man trying to get to the table behind them brushed Emenike's jacket down from behind his chair.
"Ah, look at this man. He wants to ruin my aqua scutum. It was my last birthday present from Georgina,"
Emenike said, hanging the jacket back behind his chair. Obinze did not know the brand, but he knew from the stylish smirk on Emenike's face that he was supposed to be impressed.
"Sure you don't want another beer?
Emenike asked, looking around for the waitress.
She's ignoring me. Did you notice how rude she was earlier? These Eastern Europeans just don't like serving black people.
After the waitress had taken his order, Emenike brought out an envelope from his pocket.
Here it is, man. I know you asked for 500, but it's 1,000. You want to count it?
Count it? Obinze nearly said, but the words did not leave his mouth. To be given money in the Nigerian manner was to have it pushed into your hands, fists closed, eyes averted from yours, your effusive thanks, and it had to be effusive, waved away. And you certainly did not count the money, sometimes did not even look at it until you were alone. But here was Emenike, asking him to count the money. And so he did, slowly, deliberately, moving each note from one hand to the other, wondering if Emenike had hated him all those years in secondary school and university. He had not laughed at Emenike as Kayode and the other boys did, but he had not defended Emenike either. Perhaps Emenike had despised his neutrality.
Thanks, man, Obinze said. Of course it was £1,000. Did Emenike think a £50 note might have slipped out on his way to the restaurant?
It's not a loan,
Emenike said, leaning back on his seat, smiling thinly.
Thanks, man, Obinze said again, and despite it all he was grateful and relieved.
It had worried him how many things he still had to pay for before the wedding, and if this was what it took, counting a cash gift while Emenike watched with power in his gaze, then so be it. Emenike's phone rang.
Georgina,
he said happily, before he took the call. His voice was slightly raised for Obinze's benefit.
It's fantastic to see him again after so long.
Then after a pause,
of course, darling, we should do that.
He put his phone down and told Obinze,
Georgina wants to come and meet us in the next half hour so we can all go to dinner. Is that okay?
Obinze shrugged.
I never say no to food.
Just before Georgina arrived, Emenike told him in a lowered voice,
don't mention this marriage thing to Georgina.
He had imagined Georgina, from the way Emenike spoke of her, as a fragile innocent, a successful lawyer who nonetheless did not truly know the evils of the world. But when she arrived, square-faced with a big square body, brown hair crisply cut, giving her an air of efficiency, he could see right away that she was frank, knowing, even world-weary. He imagined her clients instantly trusting her ability. This was a woman who would check up on the finances of charities she gave to. This was a woman who would certainly survive a visit to Nigeria. Why had Emenike portrayed her as a hapless English rose? She pressed her lips to Emenike's, then turned to Sheik Obinze's hand. Do you fancy anything in particular? She asked Obinze, unbuttoning her brown suede coat. There's a nice Indian place nearby.
Oh, that's a bit tatty, Emenike said.
He had changed. His voice had taken on an unfamiliar modulation, his delivery slower, the temperature of his entire being much lower.
We could go to that new place in Kensington. It's not that far.
I'm not sure Obinze will find it very interesting, darling, Georgina said.
Oh, I think he'll like it,
Emenike said. Self-satisfaction. That was the difference in him. He was married to a British woman, lived in a British home, worked at a British job, travelled on a British passport, said exercise to refer to a mental rather than a physical activity. He had longed for this life, and never quite believed he would have it. Now his backbone was stiff with self-satisfaction. He was sated. In the restaurant in Kensington, a candle glowed on the table, and the blonde waiter who seemed too tall and handsome to be a waiter served tiny bowls of what looked like green jelly.
Our new lemon and thyme aperitif with the compliments of the chef,
he said.
Fantastic,
Emenike said, instantly sinking into one of the rituals of his new life. Eyebrows furrowed, concentration sharp, sipping sparkling water and studying a restaurant menu. He and Georgina discussed the starters. The waiter was called to answer a question. It struck Obinze, how seriously Emenike took this initiation into the voodoo of fine dining, because when the waiter brought him what looked like 3 elegant bits of green weed, for which he would pay £13, Emenike rubbed his palms together in delight. Ubinze's burger was served in 4 pieces, arranged in a large martini glass. When Georgina's order arrived, a pile of red raw beef, an egg sunnily displayed on top of it, Ubinze tried not to look at it as he ate, otherwise he might be tempted to vomit. Emenike did most of the talking, telling Georgina about their time together at school, barely letting Ubinze say anything. In the stories he told, he and Ubinze were the popular rogues who always got into glamorous trouble. Ubinze watched Georgina, only now becoming aware of how much older than Emenike she was. At least 8 years. Her manly facial contours were softened by frequent brief smiles, but they were thoughtful smiles, the smiles of a natural skeptic, and he wondered how much she believed of Emenike's stories, how much love had suspended her reason. "We're having a dinner party tomorrow, Ubinze," Georgina said. "You must come."
"Yes, I forgot to mention it," Emenike said.
"You really must come. We're having a few friends over, and I think you'll enjoy meeting them," Georgina said.
"I would love to," Ubinze said.
Their terraced home in Islington, with its short flight of well-preserved steps that led to the green front door, smelled of roasting food when Ubinze arrived. Emenike let him in.
"The Zed, your Ellie, we're just finishing up in the kitchen. Come and stay in my study until the others come."
Emenike led him upstairs and into the study, a clean, bright room made brighter by the white bookshelves and white curtains. The windows ate up large chunks of the walls, and Ubinze imagined the room in the afternoon, flooded gloriously with light, and himself, sunk in the armchair by the door, lost in a book.
"I'll come and call you in a bit," Emenike said.
There were, on a window ledge, photos of Emenike squinting in front of the Sistine Chapel, making a peace sign at the Acropolis, standing at the Colosseum, his shirt the same nutmeg color as the wall of the ruin. Ubinze imagined him, dutiful and determined, visiting the places he was supposed to visit, thinking as he did so, not of the things he was seeing, but of the photos he would take of them, and of the people who would see those photos. The people who would know that he had participated in these triumphs. On the bookshelf, Graham Greene caught his eye. He took the heart of the matter down and began to read the first chapter, suddenly nostalgic for his teenage years, when his mother would reread it every few months. Emenike came in.
"Is that war?"
"No." He showed him the book cover. "My mother loves this book. She was always trying to get me to love her English novels.
War is the best of them. Brideshead is the closest I've read to a perfect novel."
"I think war is cartoonish. I just don't get those so-called comic English novels. It's as if they can't deal with the real and deep complexity of human life, and so they resort to doing this comic business. Green is the other extreme, too morose."
"No, man, you need to go and read War again. Green doesn't really do it for me, but the first part of The End of the Affair is terrific."
"This study is the dream," Ubinze said.
Emenike shrugged.
"Do you want any books? Take anything you want."
"Thanks, man," Ubinze said, knowing that he would not take any.
Emenike looked around as though seeing the study through new eyes.
"We found this desk in Edinburgh. Georgina already had some good pieces, but we found some new things together."
Ubinze wondered if Emenike had so completely absorbed his own disguise that even when they were alone, he could talk about good furniture, as though the idea of good furniture was not alien in their Nigerian world, where new things were supposed to look new. Ubinze might have said something to Emenike about it, but not now. Too much had already shifted in their relationship. Ubinze followed him downstairs. The dining table was a riot of color, bright mismatched ceramic plates, some of them chipped at the edges, red wine goblets, deep blue napkins. In a silver bowl at the center of the table, delicate milky flowers floated in water. Emenike made the introductions.
"This is Georgina's old friend, Mark, and this is his wife, Hannah, who, by the way, is completing her PhD on the female orgasm, or the Israeli female orgasm.
Well, it isn't quite that singularly focused,
Hannah said, to general laughter, warmly shaking Obinze's hand. She had a tanned, broad-featured, suckering face, the face of a person who could not abide conflict. Mark, pale-skinned and rumpled, squeezed her shoulder but did not laugh along with the others. He said, "How do you do?" to Obinze, in an almost formal manner.
"This is our dear friend Philip, who is the best solicitor in London, after Georgina, of course," Emenike said.
"Are all the men in Nigeria as gorgeous as you and your friend?" Philip asked Emenike, swooning mockingly as he shook Obinze's hand.
"You'll have to come to Nigeria and see,"
Emenike said, and winked, in what seemed to be a continuous flirtatiousness with Philip. Philip was slender and elegant, his red silk shirt open at the neck, his mannerisms, supple gestures of his wrists, fingers swirling in the air, reminded Obinze of the boy in secondary school. His name was Hadome, who was said to pay junior students to suck his dick. Once, Emenike and two other boys had lured Hadome into the toilet and beaten him up, Hadome's eyes swelling so quickly that just before school was dismissed, it looked grotesque, like a big purple eggplant. Obinze had stood outside the toilet with other boys, boys who did not join in the beating, but who laughed along, boys who taunted and goaded, boys who shouted, "Homo! Homo!"
"This is our friend Alexa. Alexa's just moved into a new place in Holland Park after years in France, and so lucky us, we'll be seeing much more of her. She works in music publishing. She's also a fantastic poet," Emenike said.
"Oh, stop it," Alexa said, and then turning to Obinze, she asked, "So where are you from, darling?"
"Nigeria. No, I mean in London, darling. I live in Essex, actually," he said.
"I see," she said, as though disappointed. She was a small woman with a very pale face and tomato-red hair. "Shall we eat, boys and girls?" She picked up one of the plates and examined it.
"I love these plates. Georgina and Emenike are never boring, are they?" Hannah said.
"We bought them from this bazaar in India," Emenike said. "Handmade by rural women. Just so beautiful. See the detail at the edges?"
He raised one of the plates.
"Sublime,"
Hannah said, and looked at Obinze.
"Yes, very nice," Obinze mumbled.
Those plates with their amateur finishing, the slight lumpiness of their edges, would never be shown in the presence of guests in Nigeria. He was still not sure whether Emenike had become a person who believed that something was beautiful because it was handmade by poor people in a foreign country, or whether he had simply learned to pretend so. Georgina poured the drinks. Emenike served the starter, crab with hard-boiled eggs. He had taken on a careful and calibrated charm. He said, "Oh dear," often. When Philip complained about the French couple building a house next to his in Cornwall, Emenike asked,
"Are they between you and the sunset?"
"Are they between you and the sunset?" It would never occur to Obinze or to anybody he had grown up with to ask a question like that.
"So, how was America?"
Philip asked.
"A fascinating place, really. We spent a few days with Hugo in Jackson, Wyoming. You met Hugo last Christmas, didn't you, Mark?"
"Yes. So what's he doing there?" Mark seemed unimpressed by the plates. He had not, like his wife, picked one up to look at it. "It's a ski resort, but it's not pretentious. In Jackson, they say people who go to Aspen expect somebody to tie their ski boots up for them," Georgina said.
"The thought of skiing in America makes me quite ill," Alexa said.
"Why?"
Hannah asked.
"They got a Disney station in the resort, with Mickey Mouse in ski gear," Alexa asked.
Alexa's only been to America once, when she was in school, but she loves to hate it from afar, Georgina said.
"I've loved America from afar my whole life," Obinze said.
Alexa turned to him in slight surprise, as though she had not expected him to speak. Under the chandelier light, her red hair took on a strange, unnatural glow.
"What I've noticed being here is that many English people are in awe of America,"
but also deeply resent it,
Obinze said.
Perfectly true, Philip said, nodding at Obinze. Perfectly true. It's the resentment of a parent whose child has become far more beautiful and with a far more interesting life.
But the Americans love us Brits. They love the accent and the queen and the double-decker,
Emenike said.
There, it had been said,
the man considered himself British.
And the great revelation Emenike had while we were there,
Georgina said, smiling,
the difference between the American and British, by.
By?
Alexa asked.
Yes. He says the Brits draw it out much more, while Americans make it short. That was a great revelation. It explained everything about the differences between both countries,
Emenike said, knowing that they would laugh. And they did.
I was also thinking about the difference in approaching foreigners. Americans will smile at you and be extremely friendly, but if your name is not Corey or Chad, they make no effort at saying it properly. The Brits will be surly and will be suspicious if you're too friendly, but they will treat foreign names as though they are actually valid names.
That's interesting, Hannah said.
Georgina said, it's a bit tiresome to talk about America being insular. Not that we help that much, since if something major happens in America, it is the headline in Britain. Something major happens here, it's on the back page in America, if at all. But I do think the most troubling thing was the garishness of the nationalism. Don't you think so, darling?
Georgina turned to Emenike.
Absolutely, Emenike said. Oh, and we went to a rodeo. Hugo thought we might fancy a bit of culture.
There was a general tittering laughter.
And we saw this quite unbelievable parade of little children with heavily made-up faces. And then there was a lot of flag-waving and a lot of God bless America. I was terrified that it was the sort of place where you did not know what might happen if you suddenly said, I don't like America.
I found America quite jingoistic too when I did my fellowship training there,
Mark said.
Mark is a pediatric surgeon,
Georgina said to Obinze.
One got the sense that people, progressive people, that is, because American conservatives come from an entirely different planet even to this Tory, felt that they could very well criticize their country, but they didn't like it at all when you did,
Mark said.
Where were you?
Emenike asked, as if he knew America's smallest corners.
Philadelphia, a specialty hospital called the Children's Hospital. It was quite a remarkable place, and the training was very good. It might have taken me 2 years in England to see the rare cases that I had in a month there.
But you didn't stay,
Alexa said, almost triumphantly.
I hadn't planned on staying.
Mark's face never quite dissolved into any expression.
Speaking of which, I've just got involved with this fantastic charity that's trying to stop the UK from hiring so many African health workers,
Alexa said.
There are simply no doctors and nurses left on that continent. It's an absolute tragedy. African doctors should stay in Africa.
Why shouldn't they want to practice where there is regular electricity and regular pay? Mark asked, his tone flat.
Obinze sensed that he did not like Alexa at all. I'm from Grimsby, and I certainly don't want to work in a district hospital there. But it isn't quite the same thing, is it? We're speaking of some of the world's poorest people. The doctors have a responsibility as Africans.
Alexa said,
life isn't fair, really. If you have the privilege of that medical degree, then it comes with a responsibility to help their people.
I see. I don't suppose any of us should have that responsibility for the blighted towns in the north of England,
Mark said.
Alexa's face reddened.
In the sudden tense silence, the air wrinkling between them all, Georgina got up and said, everyone ready for my roast lamb?
They all praised the meat, which Obinze wished had stayed a little longer in the oven. He carefully cut around his slice, eating the sides that had greyed from cooking, and leaving on his plate the bits stained with pinkish blood.
Hannah led the conversation, as though to smooth the air, her voice calming, bringing up subjects they would all agree on, changing to something else if she sensed a looming disagreement. Their conversation was symphonic, voices flowing into one another, in agreement. How atrocious to treat those Chinese cockle-pickers like that. How absurd, the idea of fees for higher education. How preposterous that fox-hunting supporters had stormed Parliament. They laughed when Obinze said,
I don't understand why fox hunting is such a big issue in this country. Aren't there more important things?
What could possibly be more important?
Mark asked dryly.
Well, it's the only way we know how to fight our class warfare.
Alexa said,
the landed gentry and the aristocrats hunt, you see, and we liberal middle classes fume about it. We want to take their silly little toys away.
We certainly do, Philip said. It's monstrous.
Did you read about Blunkett saying he doesn't know how many immigrants there are in the country?
Alexa asked,
and Obinze immediately tensed, his chest tightening.
Immigrant, of course, is code for Muslim,
Mark said.
If he really wanted to know, he would go to all the construction sites in this country and do a head count,
Philip said.
It was quite interesting to see how this plays out in America,
Georgina said.
They're kicking up a fuss about immigration as well, although, of course, America has always been kinder to immigrants than Europe.
Well, yes, but that is because countries in Europe were based on exclusion, not as in America on inclusion,
Mark said.
But it's also a different psychology, isn't it?
Hannah said. European countries are surrounded by countries that are similar to one another, while America has Mexico, which is really a developing country, and so it creates a different psychology about immigration and borders.
But we don't have immigrants from Denmark. We have immigrants from Eastern Europe, which is our Mexico,
Alexa said.
Except, of course, for race, Georgina said. Eastern Europeans are white. Mexicans are not.
How do you see race in America, by the way, Emenike?
Alexa asked.
It's an iniquitously racist country, isn't it?
He doesn't have to go to America for that, Alexa,
Georgina said.
It seemed to me that in America, blacks and whites work together but don't play together, and here blacks and whites play together but don't work together,
Emenike said.
The others nodded thoughtfully, as though he had said something profound, but Mark said,
I'm not sure I quite understand that. I think class in this country is in the air that people breathe. Everyone knows their place. Even the people who are angry about class have somehow accepted their place.
Obinze said,
a white boy and a black girl who grow up in the same working class town in this country can get together and race will be secondary. But in America, even if the white boy and black girl grow up in the same neighborhood, race would be primary.
Alexa gave him another surprised look.
A bit simplified, but yes, that's sort of what I meant,
Emenike said slowly, leaning back on his chair, and Obinze sensed a rebuke. He should have been quiet. This, after all, was Emenike's stage.
But you haven't really had to deal with any racism here, have you, Emenike?
Alexa asked, and her tone implied that she already knew the answer to the question was no.
Of course, people are prejudiced, but aren't we all prejudiced?
Well, no, Georgina said firmly. You should tell the story of the cabbie, darling.
Oh, that story,
Emenike said, as he got up to serve the cheese plate, murmuring something in Hannah's ear that made her smile and touch his arm. How thrilled he was to live in Georgina's world.
Do tell,
Hannah said. And so Emenike did. He told the story of the taxi that he had hailed one night on Upper Street. From afar, the cab light was on, but as the cab approached him, the light went off, and he assumed the driver was not on duty. After the cab passed him by, he looked back idly and saw that the cab light was back on, and that a little way up the street it stopped for two white women. Emenike had told Obinze this story before, and he was struck now by how differently Emenike told it. He did not mention the rage he had felt standing on that street and looking at the cab. He was shaking, he had told Obinze, his hands trembling for a long time, a little frightened by his own feelings. But now, sipping the last of his red wine, flowers floating in front of him, he spoke in a tone cleansed of anger, thick only with a kind of superior amusement, while Georgina interjected to clarify, "Can you believe that?" Alexa, flushed with red wine, her eyes red below her scarlet hair, changed the subject.
Blunkett must be sensible and make sure this country remains a refuge. People who have survived frightful wars must absolutely be allowed in.
She turned to Obinze. Don't you agree?
Yes, he said, and felt alienation run through him like a shiver.
Alexa and the other guests, and perhaps even Georgina,
all understood the fleeing from war, from the kind of poverty that crushed human souls, but they would not understand the need to escape from the oppressive lethargy of choicelessness. They would not understand why people like him, who were raised well-fed and watered, but mired in dissatisfaction, conditioned from birth to look towards somewhere else, eternally convinced that real lives happened in that somewhere else, were now resolved to do dangerous things, illegal things, so as to leave. None of them starving, or raped, or from burned villages, but merely hungry for choice and certainty. Chapter 30. Nicholas gave Obinze a suit for the wedding.
"It's a good Italian suit," he said. "It's small for me, so it should fit you."
The trousers were big and bunched up when Obinze tightened his belt, but the jacket, also big, shielded this unsightly pleat of cloth at his waist. Not that he minded. So focused was he on getting through the day, on finally beginning his life, that he would have swaddled his lower parts in a baby's nappy if that were required. He and Iloba met Cleotilde near the civic center. She was standing under a tree with her friends, her hair pushed back in a white band, her eyes boldly lined in black. She looked like an older, sexier person. Her ivory dress was tight at her hips. He had paid for the dress.
"I haven't got any proper going-out dress," she had said in apology when she called to tell him that she had nothing that looked convincingly bridal. She hugged him. She looked nervous, and he tried to deflect his own nervousness by thinking about them together after this, how in less than an hour he would be free to walk with surer steps on Britain's streets, and free to kiss her.
"You'll have the rings?" Iloba asked her.
"Yes," Cleotilde said. She and Obinze had bought them the week before, plain, matching, cheap rings from a side street shop, and she had looked so delighted, laughingly slipping different rings on and then off her finger, that he wondered if she wished it were a real wedding.
15 minutes to go," Iloba said.
He had appointed himself the organizer. He took pictures, his digital camera held away from his face, saying,
"Move closer. Okay, one more."
His sprightly good spirits annoyed Obinze. On the train up to Newcastle the previous day, while Obinze had spent his time looking out of the window, unable even to read, Iloba had talked and talked, until his voice became a distant murmur, perhaps because he was trying to keep Obinze from worrying too much. Now he talked to Cleotilde's friends with an easy friendliness, about the new Chelsea coach, about Big Brother, as if they were all there for something ordinary and normal.
"Time to go," Iloba said.
They walked towards the civic center. The afternoon was bright with sunshine. Obinze opened the door and stood aside for the others to go ahead into the sterile hallway, where they paused to get their bearings, to be sure which way to go towards the register office. Two policemen stood behind the door, watching them with stony eyes. Obinze quieted his panic. There was nothing to worry about, nothing at all, he told himself. The civic center probably had policemen present as a matter of routine. But he sensed in the sudden smallness of the hallway, the sudden thickening of doom in the air, that something was wrong. Before he noticed another man approaching him, his shirt sleeves rolled up, his cheeks so red he looked as though he was wearing terrible makeup.
"Are you Obinze Madueze?"
the red-cheeked man asked. In his hands was a sheaf of paper, and Obinze could see a photocopy of his passport page.
"Yes,"
Obinze said quietly. And that word, yes, was an acknowledgement to the red-cheeked immigration officer, to Iloba, and to Cleotilde, and to himself, that it was over.
"Your visa expired, and you are not allowed to be present in the UK," the red-cheeked man said.
A policeman clamped handcuffs around his wrists. He felt himself watching the scene from far away, watching himself walk to the police car outside, and sink into the too soft seat in the back. There had been so many times in the past when he had feared that this would happen, so many moments that had become one single blur of panic, and now it felt like the dull echo of an aftermath. Cleotilde had flung herself on the ground and begun to cry. She might never have visited her father's country, but he was convinced at that moment of her Africanness. How else would she be able to fling herself to the ground with that perfect, dramatic flourish? He wondered if her tears were for him or for herself, or for what might have been between them. She had no need to worry, though, since she was a European citizen. The policeman barely glanced at her. It was he who felt the heaviness of the handcuffs during the drive to the police station, who silently handed over his watch and his belt and his wallet, who watched the policeman take his phone and switch it off. Nicholas's large trousers were slipping down his hips. "Your shoes, too. Take off your shoes," the policeman said. He took off his shoes. He was led to a cell. It was small, with brown walls, and the metal bars so thick his hand could not go around one reminded him of the chimpanzee's cage at Nsoka's dismal, forgotten zoo. From the very high ceilings, a single bulb burned. There was an emptying, echoing vastness in that tiny cell. "Were you aware that your visa had expired?" "Yes," Obinze said. "Were you about to have a sham marriage?" "No, Cleotilde and I have been dating for a while." "I can arrange for a lawyer for you, but it's obvious you'll be deported," the immigration officer said evenly. When the lawyer came, puffy-faced, darkened arcs under his eyes, Obinze remembered all the films in which the state lawyer is distracted and exhausted. He came with a bag, but did not open it, and he sat across from Obinze, holding nothing, no file, no paper, no pen. His demeanor was pleasant and sympathetic. "The government has a strong case, and we can appeal, but to be honest, it will only delay the case, and you will eventually be removed from the UK," he said, with the air of a man who had said those same words, in that same tone, more times than he wished to, or could remember. "I am willing to go back to Nigeria," Obinze said. The last shard of his dignity was like a wrapper slipping off that he was desperate to retie. The lawyer looked surprised. "Okay, then," he said, and got up a little too hastily, as though grateful that his job had been made easier. Obinze watched him leave. He was going to tick on a form that his client was willing to be removed. Removed. That word made Obinze feel inanimate. A thing to be removed. A thing without breath and mind. A thing. He hated the cold heaviness of the handcuffs, the mark he imagined they left on his wrists, the glint of the interlinking circles of metal that robbed him of movement. There he was, in handcuffs, being led through the hall of Manchester Airport, and in the coolness and din of that airport, men and women and children, travellers and cleaners and security guards, watched him, wondering what evil he had done. He kept his gaze on a tall white woman hurrying ahead, hair flying behind her, knapsack hunched on her back. She would not understand his story, why he was now walking through the airport with metal clamped around his wrists, because people like her did not approach travel with anxiety about visas. She might worry about money, about a place to stay, about safety, perhaps even about visas, but never with an anxiety that wrenched at her spine. He was led into a room, bunk beds pushed forlornly against the walls. Three men were already there. One from Djibouti said little, lying and staring at the ceiling as though retracing the journey of how he had ended up at a holding facility in Manchester Airport. Two were Nigerian. The younger sat up on his bed, eternally cracking his fingers. The older paced the small room and would not stop talking.
"Bros, how did they get you?"
he asked Obinze, with an instant familiarity that Obinze resented. Something about him reminded Obinze of Vincent. Obinze shrugged and said nothing to him. There was no need for courtesies simply because they shared a cell.
"Is there anything I could have to read, please?" Obinze asked an immigration officer when she came to lead the man from Djibouti out to see a visitor.
"Read?" she repeated, eyebrows raised.
"Yes, a book or a magazine or a newspaper," Obinze said.
"You want to read?" she said, and on her face a contemptuous amusement. "Sorry, but we've got a TV room when you're allowed to go there and watch telly after lunchtime." In the TV room, there was a group of men, many of them Nigerians, talking loudly. The other men sat around, slumped into their own sorrows, listening to the Nigerians trade their stories, sometimes laughing, sometimes self-pitying.
"This now my second time,"
The first time I come with different passport,
one of them said.
Now for work where they get new.
I get one guy where they deport. Him don't come back getting paper. Now him will go help me,
another said. Ubinze envied them for what they were, men who casually changed names and passports, who would plan and come back and do it over again because they had nothing to lose. He didn't have their savoir-faire. He was soft, a boy who had grown up eating cornflakes and reading books, raised by a mother during a time when truth-telling was not yet a luxury. He was ashamed to be with them, among them. They did not have his shame, and even this, too, he envied. In detention, he felt raw, skinned, the outer layers of himself stripped off. His mother's voice on the phone was almost unfamiliar, a woman speaking a crisp Nigerian English, telling him calmly to be strong, that she would be in Lagos to receive him. And he remembered how years ago, when General Buhari's government stopped giving essential commodities and she no longer came home with free tins of milk, she had begun to grind soya beans at home to make milk. She said soya milk was more nutritious than cow milk, and although he refused to drink the grainy fluid in the morning, he watched her do so with an uncomplaining common sense. It was what she showed now over the phone, telling him she would come and pick him up, as though she had always nursed the possibility of this, her son in detention, waiting to be removed from a country overseas. He thought a lot about Ifemelu, imagining what she was doing, how her life had changed. She had once told him in university, "You know what I admired most about you in secondary school? That you never had a problem saying, 'I don't know.' Other boys pretended to know what they didn't know, but you just had this confidence, and you could always admit that you didn't know something." He had thought it an unusual compliment, and had cherished this image of himself, perhaps because he knew it was not entirely true. He wondered what she would think if she knew where he was now. She would be sympathetic, he was sure, but would she also, in a small way, be disappointed? He almost asked Iloba to contact her. It would not be difficult to find her. He already knew she lived in Baltimore, but he did not ask Iloba. When Iloba visited him, he talked about lawyers. They both knew that there was no point, but still Iloba talked about lawyers. He would sit across from Ubinze, rest his head on his hand, and talk about lawyers. Ubinze wondered if some of the lawyers existed only in Iloba's mind.
"I know one lawyer in London, a Ghanaian. He represented this man with no papers. The man was almost on a plane home, and the next thing we knew, the man was free. He now works in IT.
Other times, Iloba took comfort in stating what was obvious.
"If only the marriage was just done before they came," he said. "You know, if they had come even 1 second after you were pronounced man and wife, they would not touch you."
Ubinze nodded. He knew, and Iloba knew that he knew. On Iloba's last visit, after Ubinze told him that he was being moved to Dover the next day, Iloba began to cry.
"Zed, this was not supposed to happen like this."
"Iloba, why are you talking rubbish?"
"Stop crying, my friend,"
Ubinze said, pleased to be in a position to pretend strength. And yet when Nicholas and Ojugo visited, he disliked how strenuously they tried to be positive, to pretend almost as though he was merely ill in hospital and they had come to visit him. They sat across from him, the bare cold table between them, and talked about the mundane, Ojugo speaking a little too quickly, and Nicholas saying more in an hour than Ubinze had heard him say in weeks. Ney had been accepted into the National Children's Orchestra, and now had won yet another prize. They brought him money, novels, a bag of clothes. Nicholas had shopped for him, and most of the clothes were new and in his size. Ojugo often asked,
"But are they treating you well? Are they treating you well?"
As though the treatment was what mattered, rather than the blighted reality of it all, that he was in a holding center about to be deported. Nobody behaved normally. They were all under the spell of his misfortune.
"They are waiting for seats on a flight to Lagos," Ubinze said. "They'll keep me in Dover until there's a seat available."
Ubinze had read about Dover in a newspaper, a former prison. It felt surreal to be driven past the electronic gates, the high walls, the wires. His cell was smaller, colder,
than the cell in Manchester, and his cellmate, another Nigerian, told him that he was not going to allow himself to be deported. He had a hardened, fleshless face.
"I will take off my shirt and my shoes when they try to board me. I will seek asylum," he told Obinze. "If you take off your shirt and your shoes, they will not board you."
He repeated this often, like a mantra. From time to time he farted loudly, wordlessly, and from time to time he sank to his knees in the middle of their tiny cell, hands raised up to the heavens, and prayed,
"Father, Lord, I praise your name. Nothing is too much for you. I bless your name."
His palms were deeply etched with lines. Obinze wondered what atrocities those hands had seen. He felt suffocated in that cell, let out only to exercise and to eat, food that brought to mind a bowl of boiled worms. He could not eat. He felt his body slackening, his flesh disappearing. By the day he was led into a van one early morning, a fuzz of hair like carpet grass had covered his entire jaw. It was not yet dawn. He was with 2 women and 5 men, all handcuffed, all bound for Nigeria, and they were marched at Heathrow Airport, through security and immigration, and onto the plane, while other passengers stared. They were seated at the very back in the last row of seats, closest to the toilet. Obinze sat unmoving throughout the flight. He did not want his tray of food. "No, thank you," he said to the flight attendant. The woman next to him said eagerly, "Can I have his own?" She had been at Dover too. She had very dark lips and a buoyant, undefeated manner. She would, he was sure, get another passport, with another name, and try again. As the plane began its descent into Lagos, a flight attendant stood above them and said loudly,
"You cannot leave. An immigration officer will come to take charge of you."
Her face, tight with disgust, as though they were all criminals bringing shame on upright Nigerians like her. The plane emptied out. Obinze looked through the window at an old jet standing in the mild late afternoon sun, until a uniformed man came walking down the aisle. His belly was large. It must have been a struggle to button up his shirt.
"Yes, yes, I have come to take charge of you. Welcome home," he said humorously,
and he reminded Obinze of that Nigerian ability to laugh, to so easily reach for amusement. He had missed that.
"We laugh too much," his mother once said. "Maybe we should laugh less and solve our problems more."
The uniformed man led them to an office and handed out forms, name, age, country you have come from.
"Did they treat you well?"
the man asked Obinze.
"Yes,"
Obinze said.
"So, do you have anything for the boys?"
Obinze looked at him for a moment, his open face, his simple view of the world. Deportations happened every day, and the living went on living. Obinze brought from his pocket a 10-pound note, part of the money Nicholas had given him. The man took it with a smile. Outside, it was like breathing steam. He felt light-headed. A new sadness blanketed him. The sadness of his coming days, when he would feel the world slightly off-kilter, his vision unfocused. At the cordoned-off area near arrivals, standing apart from the other expectant people, his mother was waiting for him.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.